This is Eleanor Swend interviewing Vincent Perry in Carmel, California on March 7th, 1990. This is tape one.
All right, Mr. Perry, let's get you introduced. So, do you want to tell a little bit about your family and your how you happened to be born in San Francisco, and
well, I was very fortunate to arrive at the on November 26, 1901. The start of the 20th century, and to have had the opportunity to have lived through this great action-packed period in our history for at least most of that century. I was born in San Francisco, California, which of course was a doubly fortunate event. And my parents were a devoted couple, both San Franciscans, who had a brother and sister that married, so that there was a brother-sister relationship that made my aunt and uncle really second parents to our family.
It was your father's brother?
It was my father's brother that married my mother's sister.
Uh-huh.
And
they lived?
And they lived next to us.
Mm.
On Sacramento Street, just below Leavenworth. We were a closely knit group, and I was the oldest child. My sister Eleanor followed me, and then a brother Frank, and finally my youngest sister Mary, who arrived just 6 weeks before that terrible date in April 1906, when San Francisco suffered the devastation of the earthquake and succeeding fire.
Do you recall the earthquake at all?
It is my earliest childhood memory. I was in my own bedroom and was awakened by the smashing of a large picture of the Madonna against the wall, and my mother rushing in to douse a little kerosene lamp that I had by my bedside. My dad, early that morning, put me on his shoulders and carried me up to our roof garden, where we could look out over a large part of San Francisco, particularly the section extending southwesterly along Market Street to Twin Peaks. And there, the sight of the entire city in flames was an awesome one indeed. I suppose my dad and my uncle too began early efforts to try and get us out of our home and to some place of safety. They found a lot of cooperation in the help that soldiers of the United States Army who had been assigned to the disaster areas from their headquarters in the Presidio and provided water and food for people that had suffered a complete isolation from those essential supplies. My dad had a business in downtown San Francisco, and he left almost immediately for his office, where he got down just ahead of the advancing flames, got into his vault, and recovered all his essential business papers, including the insurance policies that covered our properties. He started back up the hill past the Fairmont Hotel, and the weight of the books was almost too much for him. At that time, he was accosted by a lonely Chinaman who said, "Me help you." This good man assisted my dad up to Clay Street, the top of Knob Hill, and there my dad took over the burden again, and he reached into his pocket and handed the Chinaman a $20 gold piece. The Chinaman said, "Me no take your money, me likey Americans," which I thought was a wonderful thing to happen, and it shows what people do, particularly under times of stress, and in this case, an Oriental who I suppose was simply trying to be a good Samaritan in his new adopted land. We waited out the first 2 days of the fire, watching it creep towards us from different directions. It was a trying time, and I know my folks were attempting to get together in some sort of organization so that an escape would be possible. My dad had many friends in San Francisco, and on the morning of the third day, he showed up with a horse and wagon. I don't know where he found it or who let him have it, but at any rate, he loaded that wagon with the things that my mother wanted to save, and in addition, clothes and some supplies. We started out that morning with me perched on the wagon beside my dad, my uncle, aunt, and mother on foot beside us, pushing the baby buggy with my brother Frank and my tiny baby sister Mary in the buggy, and Eleanor, who was about 3 years old then, trotting alongside them. We moved northerly towards, I believe, Pacific Avenue. And I suppose the direction was generally obtained from Army personnel who were doing everything to try and help the movement of refugees away from the fire area. Most people went out to the Presidio, where tents had been set up, soup kitchens provided for feeding thousands of people. My dad decided that he wanted to head eastward to Alameda County. We moved down Pacific Avenue, and apparently the Army had cleared the street enough of rubble and the remains of the burnt out structures so that we could get through. My one vivid memory is looking down those cross streets through literally tunnels formed by the towering flames that reached several hundred feet in the air and formed weird firestorms at their crests. We reached the Embarcadero and moved south along it to the ferry building. I believe we were able to get the horse and wagon on the ferry boat, although I have no clear memory of that. At least we did get across to Oakland and down to Centerville in Alameda County, where my dad's parents had a farm. We finally arrived there late that night, and with great relief and thanksgiving, we had our first normal night's sleep.
Where is Centerville?
Centerville is now part of the city of Fremont. At that time, it was a wide open farm country with a farmhouse every half mile or so. It was beautiful country, and I remember it so well because it was my first experience away from the streets and sidewalks of San Francisco. And I remember going out that next morning and seeing this tremendous fig tree, something that I had no real concept of until that moment. It was a tree that had a spread of over 100 feet and must have been planted in the very early days when my grandparents located or bought the farm. Land was close to Alameda Creek and well watered. It was excellent farming country. After that first few nights of sleep and rest and recovery, my folks found a place in San Leandro where they rented a house, and we settled there temporarily until we could get back to the reconstruction job in San Francisco. My parents went back and forth to the city, and within a very short period, I would judge it wasn't more than a month or two, they were able to collect the insurance from the Fireman's Fund Insurance Company so that they could start rebuilding. The first two structures that were put up were portable houses on Kimball Place, which is a small dead-end side street off Sacramento, close to Leavenworth. We moved there in 1907 while plans were made to rebuild our homes. And the construction was started on them so that we moved back into our new houses in a very short time, probably the winter of 1907, although I am not sure of those exact dates.
You might tell about the insurance.
Well, the insurance was a thing that was so well done because the company had no formal facilities with which to work. The Fireman's Fund Insurance Company. Mm-hmm. And they set up a outside office on Market Street, and people stood in line out in the street waiting their turn with their papers in hand, and as they approached the desk, they were automatically checked over, and if the papers were in order, the insurance was paid out without any further argument. We had no difficulty at all in recovering all the insurance on our properties in San Francisco. This, of course, greatly facilitated the early rebuilding of our places of abode.
Times have changed.
Yes, although I think that, of course, this was done in a period when there was no particular government agency to facilitate such rehabilitation, but the United States certainly did help through the judicious use of the U.S. Army services, and I think the Army deserves a great deal of credit for the controls and the early recovery that was made in San Francisco. The Presidio was a main military establishment, and it lived up to all its obligations and duties. I think that was a very impressive contribution.
So you started school then in San Francisco, back in San
Francisco? I started school almost immediately after we moved back into our home, the Reading School in San Francisco. And within a year, my dad decided that it was not the healthiest thing in the world to raise four children in the city. And that summer of 1909, perhaps it was 1908, but at any rate, shortly after I'd started school, we moved to Mill Valley in Marin County, and rented our places in San Francisco to the Chrises, who were good friends of ours. The Chrises had a high-quality furniture store on the corner of, I believe, Stockton and Sutter, at least in the General Union Square shopping area. And they were wonderful tenants, and we were fortunate to have them, and we went ahead and bought a place in Mill Valley, and I proceeded with my schooling there, and my sisters and brothers followed me. We all attended Tamil Pious High School. And when we finished, when I finished high school, the question was, what do we do about the university? And my dad decided that he wanted to keep the family together. And so we sold our home in Mill Valley and bought a place in Berkeley at on Virginia Street, just south of Euclid. The my first 6 months while the sale of the property was proceeding was spent alone on the campus in Berkeley, and of course I wanted to join a fraternity. My dad said that he didn't think too much of that idea, and it just happened that in his business relations he was in the wool business and had some close contacts with the Koshlins and others in the Jewish community in San Francisco. And he said there's a Mrs. Breslow, a widow, that lives on LeConte in Berkeley. And I've arranged to have you room and board with her. It was not particularly pleasing to me, but in retrospect, I look back and think that it did me a world of good, because it just happened that there were three or four Jewish boys that were freshmen with me and stayed at the Breslau home, and they were marvelous students, and they taught me how to use a library and how to study, and I am eternally grateful for that experience. Otherwise, I might not have gotten off to a really good start on the Berkeley campus.
What were their names?
One of them was Heller, and there were others that later became very prominent in San Francisco life. Mm-hmm. I can't recall the names now, mm-hmm. but I remember Heller very well because he was most helpful to me. And
what was his first name?
I don't remember his first
okay.
name. But he was a history major, and he told me about Henry Morse Stevens and the wonderful courses he was giving. So despite the fact that I had decided by then that I wanted to be a mining engineer, he talked me into taking two courses from Henry Morse Stevens, one war issues and the other peace issues, which were so appropriately timed because they came in the fall of 1918 and the spring of 1919, when World War II had come to a close. And Stevens was a marvelous historian and a great speaker, and I learned a lot in those two courses. They were helpful to me in my life afterwards, even though they had no direct relation to engineering.
So if you were taking an engineering course, you were not required to take any liberal arts?
No, the engineering courses at Cal at that time were so well packed with required engineering subjects, including math, physics, and chemistry, that there were no electives. I made a point of trying to take an elective because I felt that I needed at least a minimum of broadening in addition to all of the science courses that were being heaped upon me. And I tried to do that all through my 4 years. But it was a difficult thing to do because of the very strict scholastic requirements of the College of Mining. The College of Mining was particularly difficult curriculum because they insisted upon work in mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, civil engineering, and geology, in addition to the straight mining courses. Frank Probert was dean of the College of Mining, and I developed a very great respect and admiration for him. He gave most of the mining courses, although they were covered also by a fine staff, including Professor Weeks, Professor Uren, and there were others on that staff whose names I don't recall at the moment. My interest in geology was primary because I felt that I wanted to follow in the exploration branch of mining, but I realized that in order to be competent as an explorationist, you had to have the basic training of a mining engineer. And I enjoyed those courses a great deal, in addition to the ones that I took in the geology department under Andy Lawson, Lauterbach, Tucky,
Tolliver,
Eccles, the mineralogist. They were all excellent teachers. Lauterbach was particularly effective with his students in the field. He'd take us out every weekend, sometimes just through the Berkeley Hills, but also on long trips into the Sierras, where we would have a chance to actually see unique and rock relations, and he insisted on us making careful and accurate maps, taught us how to pace our distances, locate ourselves by triangulation and Brunton compass, and record with accuracy the things that we observed. He was a great observer himself and stressed the importance of observation in any kind of geological study or investigation.
Did you do a lot of mapping?
We did a lot of mapping, and that was a wonderful opportunity to learn how to do these things in the field, not just to study textbooks and learn the theory of geology. The training at Berkeley was based upon field experience and the obtaining of factual data, and was the kind of training that I found in later years to be most beneficial, and the one that I always stressed in my efforts to organize and direct a exploration team in this country or abroad.
And this was not true at all universities at that time, was it?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't, later when I took my graduate work at Columbia, I found that there was more emphasis at Columbia on the theoretical side of geology, although we did go on several field trips in upstate New York, so that I think the bigger first class schools that specialized in geological training or mining geology generally followed the primary axiom of learning how to do field work and how to put the observed facts on paper so that you had a basis for reasonable analysis of what you were looking at and what it meant.
What were some of the exciting things that were going on at that time in geology? Were there any controversies?
Well, there were some, but I didn't get into that, and I didn't have an appreciation of that until a little later on in my career, when I was finally accepted by the Anaconda Geological Department and went to Butte, Montana. And there I found a rather peculiar situation. There was very serious litigation going on between the Anaconda Company and Senator W.A. Clark interests, the Elmer Lou mine in Butte. As a beginner in the geology department, I was given the job of... of holding the tape and taking Brunton shots and doing the necessary...
Was Brunton still there?
Brunton had died, but he had left his mark in Butte, and of course a lot of the ideas of the Butte method of mapping had originated at the turn of the century by Brunton. And
what was different about the Butte method of mapping, that, or what was special about it?
There were several innovations, and many of these came into being or were practiced by the men that followed Winchell and Brunton. Reno Sales was a young geologist who came to Butte in 1900 and in 1906 became chief geologist. And he made several important changes that were certainly new to the mining profession generally. One of them, a very simple sort of a thing, and yet it was, I think, most important, was to get away from the use of bound notebooks, which engineers had used almost exclusively up to that time, and to go to a loose leaf system where each sheet upon which geological notes had been recorded could be filed properly, indexed, and used not only by the geologist who had originated the sheet, but by anyone who was called upon to follow and develop the further expression of the features that had been plotted there originally.
Now, if you wanted to make a copy of that, how did you make a copy in those days?
There were no, the copies were all made by hand methods,
did you have
drafting.
Paper?
we had carbon paper, but it was not of sufficient quality to actually use in copying those notes. The notes were brought in every afternoon, and the geologist had to take those note sheets and plot by hand the data on large maps that were kept as the basic file in the geological office. The system of mapping also included the copying of additional maps from that master map, so that maps were available in the mine superintendent's office and in the mine foreman's office. In that way, the information that the geologist had gained from his morning's observation were plotted daily and brought right up to date, so that the mining group, the operators, could use that data in planning their developments for the immediately succeeding periods. This was a very effective way of coordinating geological and mining activity. In addition to that, there was an excellent system of handwritten recommendations. Each development heading had to be based upon the written recommendation of the mine geologist. That recommendation went to the mine superintendent, who had to approve it. But after it was approved, it was a matter then of record. And the starting and the stopping of any mine heading was the function of the mine geologist. And there was very close coordination between the miners and the geologists. In fact, the cooperation in Butte was so close that the byword when the geologist would pass a miner in a crosscutter drift was, "Well, boys, how's she going? Did you find any ore today?" So it was a system based not on any high technology, but rather on just good, hard-headed common sense and the development of a team approach, so that the geologists and the mine operators worked together closely. That doesn't mean that they were always in harmony. There were lots of disputes, but there was always an opportunity to take those disputes to a higher authority if it was necessary. And it was a system that had very few flaws in it, and it operated with extreme efficiency.
We've gotten a little far afield from your geology course at Berkeley.
Well, we could...
Maybe not. Did this, for example, did Sales' system and philosophy, would that reflect back onto college campuses in their method of
It did, I suppose, to some degree.
It would in Montana.
It would have certainly in Montana School of Mines. Whether it was reflected in Berkeley or not is some question. There is some question. Although I know that when I did my graduate work at Columbia, I found that James Furman Kemp, who was at that time head of the geology department, was a very strong advocate of the Sales system of recording mine geology. And he stressed this in one of his courses, which was devoted largely to techniques of sample averaging, utilization of geological procedures in mine planning, and subjects of that general character.
Let's go way back just a bit. How did you happen to get interested in studying mining at all?
My dad wanted me to be to go into the wool business with him. He had this plant in San Francisco bought, scoured, stored wool. It was called the Western Scouring and Wool Warehouse Company. And I worked there 2 summers, and after seeing the general nature of the work, it had little appeal to me.
How old were you when you first worked there?
I was freshman in the start of my freshman year in high school. Mm-hmm. And about that same time, we had a neighbor in Mill Valley by the name of Herbert Lang. Lang had a son who was about my age, and we were good friends, and he was a mining engineer from the University of California who had worked in Montana and had been successful enough, so he came back to Mill Valley and retired at a fairly young age. And he took great delight in showing his son how to sink shafts, build head frames, etc. I, of course, became part of that boyhood coalition, and our greatest achievement was the sinking of a 14-foot shaft with timber and windlass in the backyard of the Lang home. After that, he offered me a job in a little mine he was opening up in Nevada at Round Mountain. And I spent the next summer at Round Mountain. And after that, I decided that despite my father's desires, I was not going to go in the wool business. I was going to be a mining engineer.
What did you do in the summer up at Round Mountain? Were you actually working?
Oh, yes, we worked. My brother was with me, and our great delight was to work the graveyard shift on those flumes. It was a hydraulic operation. Water was brought from the Toyabe Mountains across the valley into Round Mountain, and the gravel was washed from the alluvial deposits that circled the rhyolite intrusive that was central to the Round Mountain district. It was a great experience. I learned a lot. The mine foremen were good at showing us youngsters how to drill holes in the large boulders that were left after the hydraulic washing process and how to load those holes and ignite the charge and then run for cover. It was a lot of fun for us youngsters, and we learned quite a bit about some of the fundamentals of mining at that time.
They would never let you do that today.
Probably not. No, no. We were almost child labor, I guess.
Yes.
But it was great experience, and we were fortunate to escape without any injury or problems.
Mm-hmm.
We learned to take care of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Where did you live?
We lived at a little hotel in Round Mountain that had a dining room, and we had a very enjoyable.
You were completely
life.
On your own.
We
though.
Were
no, all, no parents
for,
there.
Oh no, no, we were completely on our own.
Well,
no,
that's interesting. So when you started the university, you already had.
Well, I'd had that background, so I was more than ever convinced of the validity of my decision that I wanted to go into the mining business, and I found that at that time the College of Mining at Berkeley had students that were oriented in a similar way. They were men that came either, or students that came either from mining families or that had mining connections.
It was a very popular department.
It was a popular department. It was a small department. There weren't many students, but I would judge there were perhaps 15 or 20 in my graduating class. And one of my two of my close friends, Larry Morrell and Abe Yates, had just finished their thesis on homestake, and when engineering day came along in our senior year, they served with me on a committee to organize the program for Engineers Day, and we set up a stamp mill in the Hearst Memorial Mining Building with a crusher and a Harding mill. We had amalgamating plates, Wilfley tables, and we had a full going mining operation for the visitors that day. And it was we found that all of the students participated in this sort of thing. They liked to operate. They liked to be part of a going concern, even though it was on a miniature scale and in a on a university campus.
Mm-hmm.
But the spirit of mining was everywhere there in that college, and we had, incidentally, we had two members of the California Wonder Team of 1921 and 22 in that group, Dan McMillan and Jimmy Dean, who were out at football practice a large part of the time, and yet they were required to carry the same scholastic load that all the rest of us did, and they did very well. I was a great admirer of both those men. They played first-class collegiate football, and yet they were able to carry their load as mining engineers at the mining school. We were very proud of that Cal Wonder team because those were the days when Cal was undefeated. In fact, I never attended a football game during my 4 years at Berkeley that Cal didn't win. And one of the most exciting trips I had was when a group of us got together the day before the last day of 1920 and drove down the coast in a rickety old Franklin steamer to Pasadena to see Cal beat Ohio State 28-0.
In the Rose Bowl.
In the Rose Bowl, yeah.
Well.
So those were some of the joys of being at Berkeley. Then besides all of the gratification we got out of our scholastic work.
Could you go to LA in one day?
Took us 2 days, two long, hard days. We left early in the morning in Berkeley and we arrived at San Luis Obispo about 11 o'clock that night. I remember going over this San Juan grade here at, out of coming into Salinas and wondering whether we were ever going to make it. And we arrived in Los Angeles just in time for the game the next day.
Well, you didn't mention Hildebrand.
Well, Hildebrand was one of our fine teachers in the chemistry department, and he was extremely popular. He was young, vibrant, took an interest in all the laboratory work. We'd be in the lab carrying on experiments in chemistry, and Hildebrand, even though we were being supervised closely by instructors, Hildebrand would always be there looking down our necks to see that everything went right and never being too strict or serious, usually coming up with some light remark or a pat on the back if things didn't go exactly right. But he was always an inspiration, and his famous experiments at big game time when he was able to show all kinds of college colors on his lecture bench was a delightful diversity to all his students.
And you liked Lawson, you said.
I liked Andy Lawson because he also was a professor that stressed the humorous side of life and science, and his famous remark, which I suppose was oft repeated about the terrible grumbling down in the bowels of the earth, always fascinated the class. He had many wise comments, and he was a very able lecturer.
Let's see, were there any other, you mentioned Lauterbach and Tolliver. I guess those are the...
I think those were the main teachers.
You felt that you got good practical academic training?
I felt that the course that was given at Berkeley was outstanding. I came away fulfilled in the sense that people that had instructed us sounded as though they knew what they were talking about. They were men that had had a good deal of experience. They spoke with conviction, and I think they made a great impression upon the students. I was very glad that I had had the opportunity to go to Cal and to enjoy that kind of contact. It was something that has been with me through all my professional life, and I am sure that the training I received was as good or better than anything that was available anywhere else. And I say that advisedly, because after I had worked a year on the Mother Lode at the Carson Hill Gold Mines, I went back to Columbia to do graduate work in geology.
How did you happen to choose Columbia?
I chose Columbia because I had an opportunity to meet a Dr. Robert Raymond, who was carrying on an investigation of the Carson Hill gold mines for a client. And my job was to take him underground and generally be his guide during his examination. And he told me that he felt that it would be worthwhile for me to broaden my education by doing some graduate work at Columbia. And his suggestions were so appealing to me that I decided that this was something that would be worth doing. I'd saved enough money from my work there at Carson Hill so that I could afford the trip back east and the then very modest financial requirements of a year at Columbia University besides living in the city of New York.
How did you get the job at Carson Hill?
Well,
let me go back. Did you work in the summers then also?
Well, I worked one summer at Carson Hill, and then I thought that it would be important for me to find a job in some different place. I didn't want to just stay in the state of California. I wanted to get out and see part of the rest of the world. So first of all, I had an offer from the testing laboratories of Anaconda at Anaconda, Montana. They were looking for testing engineers, and I had tentatively decided on going up there when I received word that because of the end of World War II and the drop in the price of copper, their testing and research activities were being curtailed. So that job was closed.
You graduated in 1922.
Yeah. Right. But the full effect of the end of the war and the economic recession that followed it was not really felt until later on in that period. Another opportunity that Dean Frank Probert had suggested to me was to go with Cerro de Pasco. And Don McLaughlin was then active as chief geologist of Cerro de Pasco and was in Berkeley for a vacation. Probert arranged an interview with Don McLaughlin, and McLaughlin gave me some encouragement and said that he would have to clear my application with Dr. Grattan at Harvard University. Grattan apparently was in overall control of the geological work of Cerro de Pasco at that time. 2 weeks later, a letter came back saying that Hugh McKinstry had been accepted as a geologist at Cerro de Pasco for the job that I had expected to get. So that was closed. My final opportunity was to go back to the place where I had worked the summer before, and I found that they were anxious to get me back on their payroll, and where I had worked before as a miner, they made me an engineer, and I worked as a surveyor there, and also in the safety department for that next year. During that time, there was we had a calamitous event. The Argonaut mine at Jackson had a disastrous fire, and I was on the safety crew at Carson Hill, and we were ordered out the middle of the night to drive over to Jackson to see what we could do to rescue the men that were trapped in the Argonaut. I believe there were 48 men trapped on the 4200 level, or at least one of the deep levels of the Argonaut. We were unable to get down the shaft. The shaft was on fire. Argonaut management had decided to reverse the fan to save the main shaft. The idea that the men could escape through the secondary exit, which was the Muldoon shaft. Apparently there was some difficulty in getting to the Muldoon shaft because the men had not been able to get out, and we couldn't reach them through the Muldoon. The net result was the Bureau of Mines arrived the next morning from Berkeley, and they told us that the only way to effect the rescue was to drive a emergency crosscut or a raise from the adjoining Fremont mine to connect with the Argonaut. It took 3 long weeks to drive that, and when we finally got through the raise and into the Argonaut mine, we found the 48 bodies piled up at the end of a crosscut, all of them dead. And it was a terrible, mean, and dirty job to recover all those bodies and haul them out of that mine and through that narrow little raise up to the surface. It was a tragedy that left a real imprint on me, and I wondered whether operating a mine was as much fun as I had expected it was going to be.
Did you think that the decision to reverse the FAM was...
Well, I am not sure whether it was right or not. I've questioned that myself, but the Bureau of Mines agreed that the management was correct in doing this. To me, it looked as though they should have let the shaft burn out and give the men a chance to get out instead of facing all the gases and smoke that they were was being circulated through the Muldoon. But that's something that you wonder whether the decision was the right one or not. It's like many of those kind of things that happen where a decision has to be made in a short period of time, and the decision, in my judgment, may have been wrong.
But you were actually with the crew then that was doing the emergency raid.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.